With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The Almond Board announces its new members after its elections. The Almond Board of California has announced the election of 5 voting members for the panel that directs global market development for the almond sector. New member Kelly Evans is a co-op grower from Evans Farming in Live Oak. Members elected were Paul Ewig, an independent grower from Los Banos, Alexi Rodriguez, an independent handler with Compost Brothers in Carruthers, Alicia Rockwell, a co-op handler with Blue Diamond Growers in Sacramento, and Darren Rigg, an independent hauler from Minturn Nut Company Incorporated in Lee Grand. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Grassley vows to fight California's Prop 12 in the Farm Bill. A key senator from the nation's top pork-producing state vows to fight in the Farm Bill, California's Prop 12, which bans the sale of pork in the state from pigs housed in cages or crowded pens where they can't freely turn around. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley says the Farm Bill is a logical place to try to kill Prop 12, not freestanding legislation others want would take 60 Senate votes and at least 6 days to pass.
I think the only place to get it done is in the Farm Bill, and what's more appropriate than the Farm Bill to make sure that animal agriculture isn't being hurt by people in California that don't know anything about animal agriculture.
But the Supreme Court in a 5-4 ruling upheld Proposition 12, rejecting a pork industry lawsuit that it violated the Constitution's Commerce Clause. Justice Neil Gorsuch, writing for the majority, said California growers overwhelmingly endorse the ethical pork law and that the Constitution says nothing about the type of pork chops that the state merchants may sell. Grassley has a different view.
Once you start allowing California to do it, there's reasons to believe that Massachusetts is the next one to do it. And then when are Midwestern farmers going to be retaliating against California fruits and vegetables and nuts?
The National Pork Producers Council, which brought the lawsuit against California, argues that Prop 12 would impact thousands of farmers, risk further industry consolidation, and raise pork prices for millions of Americans. NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
A recently identified pathogen could be troublesome for strawberry growers. Research plant pathologist with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service, Peter Henry, said there's a new strain of the fusarium wilt pathogen.
For a long time, the only strains that were identified, pathogenic strains that would cause that disease, were affected by a resistance gene in some cultivars. So the UC Davis breeding group identified a gene that confers immunity to this pathogen that's called RACE1. So Fusarium oxysporum, Forma specialis fragariae, is the name of the pathogen, and then RACE1 indicates that it cannot cause disease on these resistant cultivars. And those resistant cultivars really made it possible for many growers to stay in business and keep planting their fields, because even though the pathogen is present, those cultivars are not affected and they yield just fine. The discovery that my lab made last fall is there are other strains that had previously not been identified that can cause disease on those resistant cultivars. So we call these Fusarium wilt RACE 2 because they overcome this resistance gene that's in the strawberry genome, kind of like an arms race between the pathogen and the plant or the plant breeder.
Herbicide resistance issues have been confirmed for common chickweed in small grains and is suspected in alfalfa. As researchers continue investigating the issue, Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor Nick Clark said there is hope that the economics of resistance are manageable for growers.
I think, first of all, it's important to remember that we don't know yet if there is an economic impact of poorly controlled chickweed on these crops, and that's what we're looking for. It's kind of our hope that when we look into this, you know, we find that it really is not that big of a problem in terms of reducing yield or reducing feed quality. Now, that's a best case scenario. And if that is the case, then, you know, the recommendation for growers and pest control advisors will be pretty typical.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, we talk a lot about food safety when it comes to growing, producing, and packaging food, and also when it comes to how we cook and refrigerate things like meat. But there's a step in between, ensuring that only safe food is available on the shelves at the grocery store. I talked with Andy Tipton, the director of the Alabama Department of Agriculture and Industry's Food Safety and Ag Compliance Division, and I learned more about how they keep food safe.
Well, this division is primarily a consumer protection safety part of the department, and with inspectors throughout the state, we have 14 different regions throughout the state that an inspector is dedicated to those regions. Now, their primary responsibility would be grocery stores, convenience stores, any store that would carry a potentially hazardous food or what we call a Class A food. Potentially hazardous foods are those foods that would be able to harbor bacteria and would allow that bacteria to grow and proliferate, which would become a food safety issue or a foodborne illness.
So what do these inspectors do?
They will routinely look at dates on products. They have a sample schedule that is given to them from our food safety lab, where throughout the year they will be responsible for pulling samples, and it goes back through our lab and we look for aflatoxins, patulins, different things. Cereals are brought in, apple juice, flour, cornmeal, and they also participate, work closely with our pesticide laboratory to look for pesticide residue on fruits and vegetables. And that also is seasonal, just whatever is the most common during that time of the year would be on our inspector's sample schedule. They go through these stores routinely, look at dates, look at damaged products, look at labels. Labeling is another big part. And sometimes there are labels that have been covered over. I don't know if you've seen that before, but some labels that have been obscured, and very few people do this, but on occasions we'll run into some folks that will obscure labeling to get past some of those dates, so our inspectors are trained to look at that. On occasion, we also handle truck wrecks, anybody that's carrying potentially hazardous food to prevent that from entering into commerce that may cause a foodborne illness, our inspectors are called to that task. Refrigerated truck wrecks, warehouses that go down, storms, tornadoes, hurricanes. We work closely with public health on some of these big weather activities to make sure we cover all those stores that would be offering those products that I mentioned before to the public.
He said they also coordinate with other agencies.
We work closely with FDA and USDA on several different programs, and the largest of those would be an agreement we have with FDA in the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is FSMA. Mm-hmm. And our office takes care of the produce safety rule. There are seven components within that FSMA umbrella, the largest of which is produce safety rule. And it is a proactive approach to food safety where our folks go out and look on the farm before it enters into commerce and to make sure that the standards are met with cleaning and sanitizing. That would be equipment as well as the product itself and the processing facilities. So that is probably the biggest change that we've seen in food safety actually since the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. Wow. And this came into effect in 2016.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, during the National Cattlemen's Beef Association summer business meeting in July, members did pass a directive to continue the association's advocacy efforts on transparent labeling and inspection of cell culture protein products. NCBA President Todd Wilkinson talked about this during a recent Beltway Beef podcast.
Unfortunately, our industry is continually under attack, and those attacks come in various forms. And certainly one of the biggest right now is this cell-based product that is gaining recognition, I should say, by USDA. So, you know, in case the listeners are not aware of it, there are now chicken-blended products that have gained the ability to market in restaurants, one of them just three blocks away from our Washington office. So this is here. This is real. And what I tell producers, and when I get interviewed, I'm asked the question, what's the biggest concern that you have for our industry 10 years out? My big concern 10 years out is the fact that we have these fake products that are being sponsored by billionaires like Bill Gates and Richard Branson. And they want to take our cattle off the ground. They want to say that this product is slaughter-free, and we have to attack this both legislatively and regulatorily, and we can't be asleep at the switch. This is a generational issue. So when I say that, I expect that this issue, if we don't get it solved in the next 2 years, could impact not only my son, but my grandsons as they come into our operations. So this is one of the main topics we're hitting on.
And Wilkinson explained some of the policy aspects of NCBA's questioning on cell-cultured meat.
We want it defined. So if the product is in that refrigerated cooler in the grocery store next to the meat, and you see a product that says slaughter-free or cultured meat, you know, that's not going to bring up the true picture of the product. So we need this issue labeled correctly. And how we do that brings up a whole myriad of issues. So what we're doing right now is we're going through the committee structure, and the committees are coming out with policy that's going to give us the ability to work through this. Some of that means that we have to be able to differentiate this product, this goop that they're trying to pass off as meat. We have to be able to differentiate it descriptively, whether that means it's not labeled as meat at all, however that terminology gets worked out. That's the critical part, is getting the labeling and the terminology defined now so that when this stuff is on the grocery store shelves, it's correctly identified.
Learn more about this on their website, ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The ag lending industry is sending help to Hawaii. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Farm Credit Association, American Ag Credit, rural banking partner CoBank, and the Federal Agricultural Mortgage Corporation, also known as Farmer Mac, are donating $40,000 to Maui Food Bank to help aid during the devastating wildfires that are wreaking havoc in Hawaii. Ag Credit CEO Kurt Hadnett says, "When natural disasters impact the communities in which we live and work, we stand ready to support." CoBank's Brenda Frank adds, "The contribution to the Maui Food Bank is intended to address the immediate needs and reduce suffering of those impacted by the wildfires in Maui." Farm Credit has had a presence in Hawaii for more than 50 years. The association has been a strong provider of financial support to Hawaiian farmers and ranchers. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden says he intends to ensure that people in the state have everything they need to recover. More than 100 people are reported dead, more than 1,000 still missing. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. Farmers facing drought this year will likely collect crop insurance. The tax law allows crop insurance proceeds to be deferred if the farmer had a business practice of deferring crop sales. But there's a limitation on the amount that can be deferred. That limit will likely be in play this year. If you collect crop insurance proceeds this year, how much can you defer into next year for tax purposes? The amount that you can defer is limited to the portion related to crop damage. The portion associated with price is not deferrable. Crop damage is based on yield loss times the crop's base price before you plant the crop. If the price at harvest equals or is greater than the base price, all of your crop insurance proceeds are related to yield and will be fully deferrable. However, if harvest price is lower than the base price, the portion of the crop insurance proceeds related to the drop in price is based solely on the price drop. That means that at least some of the crop insurance proceeds won't be deferrable. You won't have to calculate the numbers. Your crop insurance provider usually reports the amount of price and yield loss when the proceeds are sent out. This year, it's looking likely that most crop insurance proceeds will be a result of a price drop and not a price increase at harvest. So don't be surprised if you won't be able to defer all of your crop insurance proceeds. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
Investments to growing animal feed indoors. Forever Feed Technologies announced a multi-million dollar investment from a renowned group of dairy and agricultural leaders to develop sustainable automated indoor growing feed mills. The climate-controlled technology will greatly reduce water, land usage, and methane emissions in helping the industry reach its goal of being climate neutral by 2050. The new investment funds will go into building the largest and most reliably controlled environmental mills, capable of feeding thousands of animals with high-quality feed year-round. In turn, that helps producers to responsibly expand their operations to meet growing demands. Steve Lindsay, a Forever Feed Technology CEO, says, quote, "We're pleased to have assembled some of the most respected dairy and agricultural leaders in the country to participate in our funding round. Forever Feed is committed to building world-class, water-saving technology that will allow our customers to sustainably grow cattle feed 365 days a year anywhere in the world. Information is available at foreverfeed.tech. And AFB contributed to that report.
Slight changes down are reported for most milk production categories in both forecast years. According to USDA's latest outlook and World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekanowski.
We lowered our milk production forecast this month by 400 million pounds for 2023. That reflects lower cow numbers and lower milk per cow, in part due to heat stress reducing productivity. And then into 2024, we also reduced our milk production forecast there by 100 million pounds, reflecting lower cow numbers.
Meanwhile, prices are up in all categories of milk product and class, except for dry whey, which is down both years.
The all milk price for 2023 currently have it at $19.95 per hundredweight. That's up 40 cents per hundredweight this month from where we were in July. And for 2024, we're forecasting $19.35 per hundredweight. That's down 60 cents year over year.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Farmers and ranchers depend on Farm Bill programs for many reasons, including improving their land. Idaho Farm Bureau member Jason Fellows says programs like EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, are essential for improving sustainability.
I was able to actually do an EQIP project 4 years ago, but the really neat thing was my grandpa did an EQIP project on the same tract of land in 1957. And so it's never ending that we can be more sustainable and focus on those things that truly help protect us as farmers and ranchers, but also help protect the land. But an EQIP program is an incentive-based program that if you look at how to be a more sustainable farmer, there's just some incentives to help you implement those practices on your farm.
Fellows says Congress needs to pass a farm bill this year, not just to promote environmental sustainability, but also to promote economic sustainability.
Because the prosperity and the future of our nation depends on a secure and sustainable food system. I don't think we recognize exactly what the farm bill does for everyday Americans. And being able to feed everybody in the nation is what we need to be focused on. It helps everybody in our nation have food to eat and fiber to live off of.
Fellows encourages all farmers and ranchers to tell their lawmakers the importance of the Farm Bill to their operation.
We need to focus on connecting the dots. Some of our elected officials don't recognize the Farm Bill affects everyday people, and we need to connect the dots not only for our congressmen, but also for average Americans to help them recognize what the Farm Bill does for each and every one of us every day. But definitely telling them our story and what the Farm Bill can do to protect our sustainable food system. And it gives us that safety net so we continue to have prosperity in our nation.
Learn more at fb.org/farmbill. Michael Clements, Washington.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination,
our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Fertilizer now let's listen in to more decline. Featured segments.
Fertilizer prices have continued their more than year-long decline through the first 2 weeks of August of this year. The University of Illinois Farm Doc Daily website shows that on a per pound of nitrogen basis, urea and liquid nitrogen fertilizers have historically been priced at a premium of 35% to 40% above anhydrous ammonia. However, the premium narrowed in 2022 as the Russia-Ukraine conflict disrupted global fertilizer markets. The premium on liquid, relative to anhydrous, has returned to more historic levels, while the gap has continued to narrow between urea and anhydrous prices. This is attributed to the continued expansion in global production capacity, combined with lower demand prospects. The continued decline in fertilizer prices improves return and income prospects as we look ahead to soon-to-be-released crop budgets for 2024. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
The hustle and bustle of the school year is now underway for some and will soon be for others. Also keeping school officials and school nutrition experts and personnel busy this time of year, making sure students have healthy meals. To that end, this recent announcement of
the Healthy Meals Incentives Initiative
that Agriculture Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small describes as a partnership between USDA's Food and Nutrition Service and the national nonprofit organization Action for Healthy Kids to provide funding support in modernizing school meal infrastructure and improving school meal nutritional quality. What might this look like at the cafeteria level? I'm Rod Bain. Coming up, a look at an initiative to increase healthy school meals in this edition of Agriculture USA. The familiar sounds of school hallways, students traveling from class to class, and a reminder that the school year is or will soon be underway. Also busy this time of year, school nutrition personnel. As Agriculture Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small recently noted, these school administrators and employees face various challenges in providing quality and nutritious meals, such as
superintendents who had schools that didn't have a commercial kitchen, so they had to figure out how to receive entire full meals from a contracting entity in order to make sure their kids had a good, healthy school meal. We've also seen the challenges when it comes to the supply chain, making sure that they have a reliability when it comes to food. And particularly in rural places, when you've got a smaller population and lower student size, it becomes even more difficult to be able to pull together the funds to have an operating kitchen that has all of the necessities to make sure that meal can be as healthy as possible.
Where this becomes increasingly important is in studies that show the correlation and value between school meals and the health of students that consume. consume them.
Every day, almost 30 million children eat a school meal. And what research tells us is that that's typically the healthiest meal that that child will eat that day. So it's important in this moment that we have to make sure that kids get a healthy meal that will help them during this formative time to be able to learn at their best and also grow into healthy adults.
That is what led to the establishment of the Healthy Meals Incentives Initiative, a federal effort involving collaboration,
which in partnership with USDA and Action for Healthy Kids is awarding nearly $30 million in grants to 264 school districts across 44 states, as well as the District of Columbia, reaching students in some of our country's highest need schools and specifically focusing on small and rural school districts.
USDA's Food and Nutrition Service allocates grant funding with Action for Healthy Kids, managing the grant selection process. The organization's CEO, Rob Bisegle, explains.
The response to the Healthy Meals Incentives Initiative has been overwhelmingly positive. We received more than 600 applications from school districts all across the United States, and we're just thrilled with the quality of the proposed projects and the applicants for those projects. Through the HMI grant, small and rural school districts will be able to modernize their operations and provide more nutritious meals that appeal to students while increasing culturally relevant foods in their communities.
An example of how grants are utilized comes from the superintendent of one of the recipient schools. This is David Edison of the Aquila, Texas Independent School District.
In our cafeteria, we have a shortage of up-to-date serving equipment. The purpose of this grant is to help us establish another line in our cafeteria. Currently, our kids are given an option of one hot meal. We would like to increase that to two hot meals. On top of that, we're going to be able to get some equipment that will better help us bring in fresh food, refrigeration that will keep our fruits a lot fresher over time, as well as a steam table to provide fresh vegetables.
Rob Bisegle adds that beyond the grants themselves, Action for Healthy Kids staff and partners will
provide in-depth trainings and individualized technical assistance to support and guide the implementation of key strategies to improve school meal quality. And Action for Healthy Kids and its partners will also help school food authorities develop creative solutions to provide nutritious foods for the children they serve. Perhaps equally importantly, we will work to make sure that successful solutions to common problems are broadly shared throughout our network to support school districts nationwide.
More details about the Healthy Meals Incentives Initiative can be found online at www.fns.usda.gov/cn/healthy-meals-incentives. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. For today's interview segment, we're taking a listen to a portion of the Vineyard Team's latest podcast episode. Show host Craig McMillan talks with Cliff Omart, who's the principal of Omart Consulting Services. They reflect on his 40-year career in agriculture.
Our guest today is Cliff Omart. He is principal with Omart Consulting Services. And today we're going to talk about a little bit of perspective on what's happened in the past and what's looking forward to in the future in the realm of sustainable wine growing and sustainable crops just kind of in general. Thanks for being on the podcast, Cliff.
You're very welcome, Craig. It's nice to be with you.
Just as full disclosure, Cliff and I have known each other a long time. It's been really fun to see the things that he's worked on over the years and his insights into kind of what's worked and what hasn't. So again, thanks for being on the program. You've been involved in a whole variety of different crops in a lot of different capacities over the years with different projects, some of them with UC, I believe, and then also in the private sector. But how did you first get involved in this kind of thing? How did you get involved in sustainable farming?
Yeah, I love that question because it wasn't deliberate at all. I was very deliberate in my education. I wanted to be a professor of forest entomology. So I got a bachelor's degree in forestry and forest entomology and a PhD in forest entomology. And so basically, since it wasn't deliberate, but unbeknownst to me, I got a very comprehensive education, especially as an undergrad in biology, ecology. It's a pretty intensive program at the College of Forestry at Syracuse. And then going to grad school, again, insect ecology, plant pathology, things like that. And then I wanted to be a research scientist at a university. So the only job going at the time I got out was actually in Australia. So I spent 13 years as a researcher in forest entomology. And again, unbeknownst to me, all of this was really giving me a very, very solid background to get into ag. My family and I, after living in Australia for 10 years, made a difficult decision to want to come home. And so I had two fellows that I went to grad school with who started an IPM company in Chico, California. Going to Berkeley for a PhD, you get a very strong background in integrated pest management. So you're all IPM people, and that's how I got into ag. And I was a pest control advisor for 7 years. It was a very unusual company in that three PhDs doing PCA work.
That is unusual.
Yeah, working, especially in the 1980s, early 90s is when I worked with them. So we were really out there, independent PCA company. So we charged for our services. We didn't sell products. The thing was that they were very big IPM guys. We worked in orchard crops and we were all entomology types. So both insects and disease management, especially in almonds, they had a great IPM program for almonds. So then being there led to a contract with the Lodi Wine Grape Commission to help them write a grant. And then if they got the grant, we would administer the grant for them in helping them develop their integrated pest management program for wine grapes. So we got the money and I ended up in charge of that project. Interestingly, having such a strong background in pest management, I quickly realized compared to the crops I'd worked on, wine grapes at the time really didn't have what I would consider challenging pest management issues. Of course, there was part of mildew, which people in Lodi were managing very well, mainly sulfur applications. So all of a sudden, it's like, hey, why don't we actually focus on the whole farm? So using that IPM background of, you know, economically viable, socially just, and environmentally sound, let's look at the whole farm. That's really how it developed. So very quickly, we started calling our program a sustainable wine growing program. And one thing led to another. We developed a reputation for our progressive nature, quote unquote, progressive. You know, we were very practical farmers. So that's how I got into it. And after the first year of working on that grant, they offered me a staff position and I realized what a great opportunity. So I took it. So that's a long road to get to it. But what's interesting is, you know, we're talking about 30 years ago now. So I've been at it a long time. But that's how I got there. It was for somebody that was so laser focused on what they thought they wanted to do, I never would have expected to get there where I ended up. But of course, it's been fantastic, as you know.
It's all about the journey.
Yeah.
Most of us end up in places we never expected.
That's one of our mantras in Lodi is sustainable farming is not about crossing a finish line. It's about the journey because you're never going to be there. You know, it's very almost zen.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have my own perspectives on this, but this is why I wanted to have this conversation with you is, you know, when you go back and you look at something like, say, 30 years ago, you know, there were certain farming practices in different crops and some applied to cross crops that came along and the science was starting to show that there was some potential. And then some of them were adopted by different types of growers and others were not. Some became kind of industry standards and others kind of did not. And again, you can think across crops, you know, what were some of the things that you saw that came along that seemed absolutely crazy at the time that ended up being widely adopted?
I can't think of anything that I thought was crazy. Now, growers would have thought they were crazy, but you know, this is the advantage I had of coming from the research community and the background I had, learning how to talk to growers who have lots of important concerns. But interestingly, the thing that got me early in the early days was cover cropping in-one grapes. And how, if there was one, and no matter what project we did, and we did things like develop that self-assessment workbook, all around sustainable wine grape growing, that was the one topic that I would get in the most arguments over. And to me, it seemed like such a no-brainer, but that's me. Back to my orchard days up in Chico, because of where they were and the rainfall they had, there was a natural cover crop in all the almond orchards, and they mowed them. And then, of course, Scientific Methodist was the name of the company. They had clients down around Fresno, and down there, everything just got tilled and floated and all of that. And I could never figure out, and of course, some of it's rainfall, but then when I started working on wine grapes, it was clear, my interpretation was, it was literally like a tradition. You till as soon as you can in the spring and get this incredible, and of course, Lodi had these amazingly deep soils, trying to convince growers that there's all these great reasons for growing cover crops was a long, slow battle. And what I always chuckled about was, oh, but Napa, we grow cover crops, you know, and I'd go over there in the middle of summer and there was bare dirt everywhere.
Right.
I think you found that there's something about cover crops. I understand if you plant them, that costs a lot of money, whatever. But yeah, so that was the one thing, the thing that I've seen happen over time, of course, is so many people now, and I'm thinking of orchard crops, especially, but wine grapes were using drip irrigation pretty early, but now so many orchard crops have them. Whether, I don't think growers necessarily thought it was a crazy idea, but for various reasons, it took a while for that to really catch on. And yet it's such an important way to manage your water as well as crop health. The other thing, being a data guy, because of my research background, the sort of high level, I would call it convincing growers that measure to manage is really the best way to farm sustainably, no matter who you are. Talking to a natural organic farmer, because they felt like they were doing great stuff, they were just as bad as not managing and measuring stuff as the conventional farmer, because they felt like they didn't really need to. So we're talking about the thing that got me in my early days, I developed a computer software system using barcodes for company in Chico. And it really was in the early days. I had a laptop in my truck. I had barcode readers for data collection because we collect data sheet. We gave growers data sheets every week. And it was all about this measure to manage. When the first software company started, and Sure Harvest was one of the earliest to come up with farm data management systems, it didn't get widely adopted. And I asked myself why. And I think it's because in those days, growers weren't doing a lot of measuring to manage. Now, I think you know, growers, because they're on site all the time, they have the incredible wealth of experience in their head. I learned very quickly that what's in your head and what you think you're seeing may not be exactly what you have, what's really going on based on what you're measuring. So that was one, you know, connected to that is over time, autonomous devices for capturing data. And weather station was one of the first, soil was one of the next. And over time, you know, and those cost money. And so over time, I've seen more and more of that. Now, I think we've actually reached the point is companies are selling things to growers that is sort of ahead of its time. I'm worried that growers are getting ripped off in a way, some growers, depending on what they're buying from companies. So, but this measure to manage, I think over time has really changed things. And then things like solar, I think in the early growers would have thought, boy, that's crazy. One thing I enjoyed about wine grape growers seem more willing to adopt new things. So like solar really started catching on for pumps, especially. And now I think it's more and more common. And then things like measuring moisture stress with pressure bombs. I can remember in my forestry days, so we're talking about back in the 60s and 70s, growers, well, bark beetle people were measuring moisture stress in pine trees, but they had to do pre-dawn moisture stress, you know, which was, it's bad enough to go out in the vineyard in the middle of the day. They had to go out when it was dark. because they were looking for what trees are stressed or not, but it's the same idea. So all of a sudden, people started coming up with using pressure bombs in orchards and vineyards, again, around irrigation, all good stuff. And so I saw that come on. And then coupled with this as well is just this whole, clearly farm workers are still underpaid, but things have gotten, you know, more and more growers are paying healthcare, more and more growers are paying for time off. I've seen that change. Again, 30 years ago, I think growers would have thought that's crazy stuff.
Again, this was just a portion of the podcast. To listen to the full episode, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
As harvest begins, the American Seed Trade Association reminds farmers to be diligent in taking the proper precautions to ensure treated seed does not enter the domestic or export grain supply. When properly handled, seed treatments are an effective agronomic tool that provides seeds the necessary protection for a strong, healthy start. Completely remove all treated seed left in containers and equipment used to handle harvested grain and dispose of it properly. Always be careful to follow state and federal guidelines for proper handling, storage, and disposal of treated seed. For more information, visit seed-treatment-guide.com or contact your seed dealer.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Registration is open for the 2023 Weed Science School at UC Davis. The intensive 2.5-day course offers hands-on training and will include 4 rotations where participants can be involved in weed identification, spray nozzle demonstration, an adjuvant demonstration, and an herbicide symptomology lab. The course will take place at the Boley Plant Science Teaching Facility September 19th through the 21st. The course provides a rare opportunity for professionals to efficiently update their understanding of weed science and the action of herbicides in the plant and the environment. Emphasis is on herbicides registered for use in California and important weeds within the state. Speakers include researchers from UC Davis, USDA, Cal Poly, and North Dakota State University. More than 30 hours of continuing education units have been approved for the course. More information about the Weed Science School is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.